Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
WBUR Podcasts, Boston.
I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and you're listening to The Common. Max Larkin, WBUR education reporter, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Daryl, thanks.
Oh yeah, thank you for coming back to The Common, man. So glad to have you. So Max, we have you with us today because last week was a pretty big week for higher education. Maybe better for some than others, right? But the U.S. Education Department launched a civil rights investigation into Harvard University's legacy and donor admissions policies, which give preferential treatment to certain students who come from, you know, families of alumni or donors, right?
That's right.
And then alongside this news, you know, about the same time, a study came from Harvard and Brown researchers that found that not only are legacy students more likely to be admitted to some elite colleges and universities than students who are not legacy, but also the study found that wealthy applicants are more likely to be admitted to these top-tier schools altogether. Now, Max, I know you have been following this, but I want to start with the study. Tell us more about what's in it.
I think there's a lot in it. It, as you said, it's sort of broadly about the college admissions advantages for really affluent students at the 12 most selective colleges in the country. So it found that students from the wealthiest, that is to say highest income, 0.1% of American households, they've got more than twice as good of a chance of getting into those colleges as people who aren't from those households. Mm-hmm. But legacy preferences, what we're discussing, they were a big part of that. About half of the effect can be explained by that, because a lot of the nation's richest families, after all, have an Ivy League graduate or two in them. I think mm-hmm. most interestingly, though, it found that being a legacy student is not predictive of future post-college success. It doesn't mean you're likelier to work for a prestigious firm or go to a prestigious graduate school or be especially high earning yourself. I think one thing that's a bit uncomfortable about this, Daryl, is that this was in part by Harvard economists, including Raj Chetty. And mm-hmm. they found basically that Harvard's own practices help what they called the persistence of privilege across generations. I felt like it was like the movie Scream, you know, the call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I was just thinking the same thing. And that sounds like he's exposing what appears to be this tool to maintain, I guess, class position and class privilege, you know? Is that fair to say?
This is what critics of legacy preferences kind of hone in on, is that basically, if you are born to the graduate of Harvard or Yale or Princeton or Stanford, you are likelier to be higher income. You are likelier to have exposure to, you know, enriching summer camps, study abroad, high-performing high schools. And then to give a bonus on top of that sort of genetic bonus feels mm-hmm. really unfair.
Because you're basically giving an opportunity to somebody who may not have had to work as hard for it as someone who did not come from wealth, right? Who did not have all those opportunities and resources to like fortify their education, you know?
Yeah, precisely. I think sometimes people wonder, you know, 50% of college students in this country go to community college, and people wonder why we talk about selective elite school so much. And I think mm-hmm. one defense of talking about them at least a little bit is that they are these incredible engines of social mobility. Like if you're a low-income student and get into them, you can change your life.
So Max, how does this information line up with the allegation against Harvard that led to the federal investigation.
Yeah. So basically, you had a group of Greater Boston groups like the Chica Project, which I think is based in Quincy, Greater Boston Latino Network. They put together a complaint. And that complaint said that legacy preferences overwhelmingly favor white applicants, not touching social class necessarily. And 70% of legacy students were white in the period that they reviewed. And so they argued to the federal government that this functions as a form of racial discrimination. And federal education officials took them up on it, announcing that investigation a week ago. I don't think we have a clear time frame for that investigation yet, or know quite what to expect in terms of its findings. But Michael Kippens, who's an attorney for Lawyers for Civil Rights, which is based in Boston, he wrote the complaint, and he explained that the feds now will get another look into the used-to-be black box of Harvard's admissions process.
This is a situation where the Department of Education has broad powers to collect information from Harvard, to speak to witnesses, to really dive deep into the data that is presented.
And I think it shows, Daryl, just how political the process of college admissions has become. You know, the Supreme Court case that overthrew affirmative action was part of a push from the political right to do just that. And now you have groups on the political left challenging the process from their own point of view.
All right. So, Max, we had this affirmative action decision in June. That's kind of where the conversations around legacy admissions started, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And fair is an interesting word here. The allegation in the affirmative action case was that in giving benefits, particularly to Black and Latino students, schools like Harvard were being fundamentally unfair to particularly Asian American applicants in a way that violated federal civil rights law. And the Supreme Court upheld that point of view. But I think by problematizing or raising the issue of fairness in college admissions, it was inevitable that people would look at these other practices and say, wait, well, why is that fair? And so now you've got colleges a little bit on the back foot defending things they do that might impede racial and socioeconomic diversity on their campuses.
Max, I'm curious because, tell me if I'm wrong, but you went to Harvard, right?
I did, yes.
What?
They call it the H-bomb. I'm not too keen on talking about it.
Well, I mean, how did you see this play out on campus? Like, did you know a lot of legacy students? What did you see?
Yeah, 100%. Harvard is this strange experience where you... I'm not a legacy student, but you meet people, and then it turns out that their father or their mother and their grandfather has gone to the school. That's a very common experience, right? The campus has a great many legacy students on it. I think one of the odder things at Harvard or at other elite, prestigious, you know, selective institutions is that everywhere you go, if you come from like a middle-class family, you are running into super, super wealthy people. I think that there are good reasons for colleges to want to admit wealthy students. They tend to be pretty well prepared. They can donate. They can afford full tuition. I don't think we're, even if we do away with legacy admissions, we're not going to do away with wealthy people being overrepresented at selective schools.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Max, you're here with us at WBUR, and you cover education in the Boston area. Can you tell us what universities and colleges in the area are still using legacy admissions, aside from Harvard, of course?
Basically, this is not a practice, Daryl, that schools like to brag about. It's kind of a quiet practice, but we took a look recently at the 10 most selective schools in the state, and the only ones that are openly not doing legacy preferences are MIT since at least 2012, and I think longer than that, Olin College of Engineering, which is from 1997, so wouldn't have that many legacy applicants anyway, and Amherst College, which suspended the practice 2 years ago. And so the practice is widespread. And I think it's safe to assume that it might enter into the calculus at most of the really selective schools, except for those three.
Have you talked to any students or educators about this?
I haven't talked to many young people about legacy preferences in particular, but in the wake of the affirmative action decision, you had a lot of student activism, sincerely, at Harvard, rallies in response and, you know, kind of political advocacy going on. And basically what they say is, we liked affirmative action because it helped our campus look a little bit more like the world outside, to function as like a model community for what they repeatedly call a multiracial democracy, which after all is what we live in and aspire to live in. And so you do have both students and educators being out and proud about the fact that they want legacy preferences to end as a practice.
How have colleges and universities responded to the scrutiny of legacy admissions?
Yeah, it hasn't been a tidal wave of schools saying they're not going to do legacy preferences anymore. As far as I'm aware, only one, Wesleyan University in Connecticut, abandoned the practice since the Supreme Court made its decision on affirmative action in late June. That being said, I think Amherst College out in Western Mass had anticipated this political controversy around legacy preferences and got ahead of it by ending the practice a couple of years ago. And in their first class, Daryl, since they ended legacy preferences, it's worth noting that the number of legacy admits fell considerably from, I think, 12% to 6%. But 6% means students who are the children of Amherst alumni are still getting in. And meanwhile, they're making room for more first-generation students because not quite as many of them are getting in.
Mm-hmm. How has Harvard responded?
Harvard isn't noted for its openness. they have defended this practice succinctly in the past, saying that it's a way to maintain relationships with alumni and a way of rewarding them for all that they do for the school, from interviews to donations. But when I reached out to them in the wake of this investigation beginning, they said they have begun a review of their admissions practices, both to make sure that they square with what the Supreme Court ordered a few weeks ago, and presumably looking at whether legacy preferences still have a place there.
Well, Max, thank you so much for coming through to the Common and talking to us about this. We really, really appreciate it.
No problem.
That's WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Common. Hey, do us a favor. Go to your favorite podcast app where you listen to us and rate and review us. We'd really, really appreciate that. In the meantime, if you have any thoughts on this episode, please hit us up on Instagram at WBURTheCommon or send us an email at thecommon@wbur.org. I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.